Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This morning, Attorney General Eric Holder appealed for people to, quote, express themselves peacefully when the grand jury releases its decision over whether to charge Ferguson, Missouri police officer Darren Wilson for fatally shooting Michael Brown. Here are just a couple of headlines over the past few days. Reuters, more arrests as protesters await Ferguson grand jury decision. KMBC, Kansas City, Ferguson schools prepare to protect kids after grand jury decision. And Newsweek, arrests made intense Ferguson ahead of grand jury announcement. The majority of stories warn of violent protests and focus on Missouri Governor Jay Nixon's decision to activate the state's National Guard and declare a state of emergency in anticipation of the decision. Today's guest, journalist Lawrence Lanahan, writes that, quote, what's missing from this coverage are the regional dynamics of racial inequality, the policies and systemic realities in housing, criminal justice, schools, and the workforce that enabled and sustained that inequality, and the anger and mistrust and frustration that eventually helped create the circumstances in which young black men like Michael Brown get shot, end quote. Lawrence Lanahan is a freelance radio and print journalist and former senior producer of WYPR's Maryland Morning. In 2010, he successfully developed a year-long series that focused on race and class for WYPR, Baltimore's NPR station. And he's got a piece at the Columbia Journalism Review called Ferguson Before Hashtag Ferguson. Behind every Michael Brown is a story of structural racism waiting to be told. Hi, Lawrence. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Mariah Stewart. She is the Huffington Post's Ferguson Fellow. Mariah began covering the shooting days after it occurred without any financial backing because she said it was news. Hi, Mariah. Welcome to the show. Great to have you.
Hello there. Thank you.
And we're joined by Shane Bauer, senior reporter with Mother Jones, where he covers criminal justice and human rights. One of his latest pieces is called The Making of the Warrior Cop, Drones, Sniper Rifles, Armored Vehicles, and a $1 billion Credit Line, 72 hours with the nation's top SWAT teams. He went to a Oakland Marriott Convention Center where a number of SWAT teams, mostly men, dressed in camouflage, were selling just a number of various weapons and other devices, and we'll talk with Shane about that. Hi, Shane. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off by giving kudos to reporters who did a good job this day, this week, and to highlight good journalism. So why don't we start off with you, Lawrence? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
It was a piece at colorlines.com. And it was about a group in Ferguson called the Lost Voices. These are just people from around Ferguson who kept running into each other at protests and started organizing together to use nonviolent methods to kind of hold police and elected officials accountable. And it's not like a magazine or newspaper journalism piece. It's got a short write-up about who they are, but then it's just a five-minute video of fairly young people in Ferguson mm-hmm. just explaining the kind of rock and a hard place they're between right now, where they want things to be nonviolent, but they want to be heard, and they're not the ones that the media is talking to. So it's just 5 minutes of them saying, you know, this is where we're at right now, and this is about to come down, and it's going to come down on us, not just the rest of the country.
Yeah, I'm glad you pointed that one out, and we'll talk about this later in the show, but we've been looking at a lot of the headlines and have noticed that a lot of the voices of the people on the street are missing from most national stories. Is that what you're seeing?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen every piece of coverage, and I don't want to lambast the whole media, but I do feel like just to your average person who's half paying attention to all this, they're getting a lot of footage from the street, arrests, and just this sense of, you know, the media trying to reassure them or not about how it's all speculative now, how violent are things going to be when this thing comes down. And, yeah, you're not hearing a lot from people about why they're out there in the first place.
All right, so kudos to Color Lines for that video. Thank you for that. What about you, Mariah? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
It definitely had to be my colleague at Huffington Post, Matt Sledge. He asked Governor Nixon the ultimate question of where the buck stops. As you may have heard, Governor Nixon kind of stumbled on that question and didn't really give us a straight-ahead answer, and I just think it was a question everyone wanted to know.
Can you elaborate on that? I mean, can you give us some context behind that question?
Yes. So basically, Governor Jay Nixon, he stated that Missouri is in a state of emergency, and Matt went on to ask during this conference call, because, you know, where does the policing end between protesting? Does Governor Jay Nixon have the last call on that? And he asked, does the buck ultimately stop with you, Governor Jay Nixon? And he kind of just fumbled upon it, said he doesn't spend a tremendous amount of time personalizing, and just stumbling on the answer.
All right. And the National Guard arrived on Monday, is that right?
Yes, they are here.
Okay. All right. So thank you for that, Mariah. And what about you, Shane? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
You know, I'm going to cheat a little bit. My story that I'm thinking of is a little more than a week old, but it's just really stuck with me. It's a story called My Captivity of the New York Times by Theo Padnos, and it's a story of his captivity with the Nusra Front. He was released in August by the Nusra Front, where he was held for 2 years in Syria. And the piece, it's a long-form piece that is really amazing. It's beautifully written, and he kind of takes you through his experience of being tortured and just all of this stuff that is really hard to imagine. But he also writes it kind of as a journalist. He was in Syria as a journalist, and he really gives us insight into the kind of inner workings of the opposition movements in Syria. You know, he kind of shows us how the Nusra Front collaborates with the Free Syrian Army, which is a group that the United States supports. In fact, the Free Syrian Army, when he escaped a couple of times, turned him back over to the Nusra Front, which is an al-Qaeda group. And he kind of shows us how these groups like the Nusra Front and ISIS are the ways that they're at odds, and a lot of it has to do with control of resources, control of oil. I really recommend it. It's just a really moving and insightful piece.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Well, thank you for that. That is Shane Bauer, senior reporter with Mother Jones. Mariah Stewart is Huffington Post Ferguson Fellow, and Lawrence Lanahan is a freelance radio and print journalist, former senior producer of WYPR's Maryland Morning. And we will put links to all of these stories at yourcallradio.org. And Shane, speaking of Syria, you were in the Middle East in the summer, and your latest story in this month's Mother Jones is about a young couple you met in 2009 in the Yarmouk refugee camp in Syria. And you write about how their lives were torn apart by the regime and the various opposition forces. Why did you decide to tell their stories?
You know, it had been a few years since I was in Syria, and I went back to Lebanon, where a lot of my old friends were refugees. And, you know, I kind of went there knowing that I wanted to write about Syria, and realized after being there that the story that I wanted to tell was about this neighborhood. It was a neighborhood that I lived in with Sarah Short, who's now my wife, and it was a Palestinian, originally a Palestinian refugee camp that kind of became this densely populated part of Damascus. And the story that they, that ended up telling was about two people that were part of this kind of community of artists that I knew, that I was friends with while I was there. And this couple, was part of this kind of vibrant community, vibrant neighborhood, and they stayed on through what has become one of the worst sieges in modern history that's still ongoing in Yarmouk. The Syrian regime has, surrounded it for about a year and a half. People have starved. There's, snipers on rooftops. People can't get out. And so I spent a lot of time with one of them, this woman, Wad, who told me her story in detail. And, it was kind of in some ways a personal story for me, because it was this place that I lived and loved, and, the people that I knew that I've seen kind of spread all over the world now. And I think it also was the best way that, in wanting to write about Syria, it's kind of this conflict that is so incredibly complicated and hard to understand, and I just realized that the best way to tell the story is to tell the story of one or two people. and all of these kind of issues come into play through their lives. You know, they're up against the regime, they're up against opposition groups, you know, they're kind of getting played in many different ways, and their life really showed that.
I just read that, Shane. I just want to say it was really great. And I learned more about Syria from an hour reading what's a love story than I have in reading a lot of other stuff. I think telling a love story just really, really drove so many complex things home in such an easy-to-grasp way.
Wow. Well, can you elaborate on that, Lawrence? What did you learn in the story that you're not getting from other pieces about Syria?
The day-to-day life, you know, what it's like trying to keep your family together, what it's like trying to eat, how complicated it can be to go four blocks. I mean, just every little tiny thing that you take for granted here becomes very, very complicated, and you take great risks every time you make an ordinary decision. And it's not just life at stake or a community at stake, a persecuted community at stake. It's literally like this ability of two people who love each other to continue living together. And it's just very striking when you look at it through that. You know, everybody's been in love, so not everybody's been in a neighborhood of refugees, but everybody's been in love.
And Shane, the crimes of the Syrian regime are not getting much attention these days, even though the regime is using barrel bombs to attack the opposition-held areas. Most of the focus now is on ISIS. Why do you think there's so little coverage of what the Syrian government continues to do to its own people?
You know, that was interesting because when ISIS kind of, you know, did this massive invasion of Iraq, it was while I was in Lebanon reporting the story. And, you know, ISIS was active before, but it wasn't as much of a threat as it is now. It wasn't as powerful. And everybody in Lebanon that I was talking to, you know, they came from kind of Damascus and South Syria, so ISIS was kind of this faraway threat for them. Their everyday issue was the regime, and it is no less now. I mean, it's still the same. Yarmouk is still under siege. Many, many parts of Syria are under siege and are dealing with barrel bombs. And, you know, it's not as if the Syrian regime has let up, but now you have this situation where, you know, I think the West is very concerned about ISIS. And, I mean, ISIS, you know, there's no doubt that ISIS is insane, and it's, people are terrified of them. I mean, all across Syria and really across the Middle East. But, you know, as far as killings, mass imprisonments, it's not much of a difference, you know, when you compare them and Assad. The difference is that they're kind of expansionist. You know, and Assad is, it's not, he's not as much of a threat outside of Syria. And I think that the U.S. and the West in general is, you know, afraid of this kind of Islamist group. So, you know, all of this stuff that we're seeing about Assad is just kind of, you know, we're not really seeing stories about that anymore. It's all about ISIS, but it's, you know, it's going on just as much as it was before. Hmm.
Shane Bauer is a senior reporter with Mother Jones, and you can find his piece called The Hunger Game. It's far more archaic and brutal at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Lawrence Lanahan, freelance radio and print journalist, former senior producer of WYPR's Maryland Morning, and Mariah Stewart, Huffington Post's Ferguson Fellow. She began covering the shooting of Michael Brown just days after it occurred. So let's move on and talk about Ferguson now. This is getting national headlines for obvious reasons. This morning, Attorney General Eric Holder appealed for citizens to, quote, express themselves peacefully when the grand jury releases its decision over whether to charge police officer Darren Wilson for fatally shooting Michael Brown. And Mariah, you are in Ferguson. I understand that the national media have descended on Ferguson. What is the mood like right now? What changes have you seen in the last few weeks?
I've definitely seen people at protests who weren't there before protesting, and it seems like they're putting on kind of a show. The night before last, there were a couple of guys in the anonymous mask, and they were holding up traffic and kind of just posing for pictures and photos, and that's something you don't see from your regular crowd of protesters.
And so that's different. What about national media reporters who were there?
National media reporters, they kind of just follow where the action is. I can't really say anything bad about them all. There's usually only one or two that kind of, you know, aren't with the groove of things. But for the most part, there are a lot of media here, and I appreciate national media now. I know at first I kind of looked down on them for coming in and parachuting in, and but they do a lot of things that local reporters can't.
Like what?
Well, they're able to shake and rattle things up. Here, when you're local, you develop these relationships with police and local officials, and you kind of have to stay in good graces so that you can keep the interviews going for the future, whereas national media, they can come in, ask the hard questions, and then get out of Dodge.
Well, and Mariah, I mean, you've got a really interesting story, because the shooting of Michael Brown occurred on August 9th, not very long ago, and you're a young freelance journalist. You graduated from Lindenwood University in May. You started covering Brown's shooting just days after it occurred without any financial backing, because, as you said in a Pointer interview, it was news. And then this week, the story turned into a year-long assignment for you, and you were named the recipient of the Huffington Post's Ferguson Fellowship.
Yes, it is unique, and I'm really thankful for Huffington Post, and especially Beacon Reader as well, because before Huffington Post, I had signed on to BeaconReader.com, the crowdsourcing website, and was getting paid by them. They hired me right away, and I'm really thankful for that. But what puzzled me is I graduated with quite a few journalists who live 30 minutes away from Ferguson, and I didn't understand how you could call yourself a journalist or a photojournalist and not go down to Ferguson. Even if you were a little bit scared of what might happen at night, you could always go at the daytime and feel a little bit more secure. But it was news. It was happening. It was this event that never took place within my lifetime in St. Louis. So, yeah, I didn't understand how no one could not go.
And in the Pointer piece, Benjamin Mullen pointed out that you have this journalism job, but you also work at the mall to make ends meet. Is that still the case?
No, it's not. Well, what happened was, because my relationship with Beacon and Huffington Post, it all happened so fast. So, I mean, all my days were blurred together pretty much. So I was with them all, but I eventually put in a 2 weeks notice with them, and now I'm full-time.
All right. Great. So you're a full-time journalist now.
Yes.
Well, so it's interesting. Lawrence, what are your thoughts on Mariah's comments about her sort of being weary of the national media at first? They fly in and then they fly out, but now she feels like the national media, they're the ones that have the power to really get the word out and change things.
Yeah, I had a similar conversion when I wrote my essay, because I was kind of skeptical of some of the stuff I was seeing. I mean, I know you have to cover the protests when there's unrest. It is news. It's the most immediate kind of breaking news. I just felt like, okay, that's half the story. So where's the part about how St. Louis got to be the ninth most segregated area in the country and what the kind of conditions that lead to these conflicts. And then they started dripping out. Mm-hmm. Radley Balco, who oddly also writes about the militarization of police, went into Ferguson and wrote this really huge, masterful thing about how these little tiny municipalities around the city developed, that white families would flee, the city, and then it's really easy to incorporate a town in Missouri, right? So you'd have a very small, mostly white town, and they'd incorporate and then use whatever vague zoning laws or whatever they could to keep the community white and middle class. And then black families would move there, and then they'd move out a little further and incorporate another town. And now you've got, I mean, Mariah, you would know better than me, something like 90 municipalities surrounding the city?
Oh, yeah. We just went to Country Club Hills, where the court is a small house.
Hmm.
there's probably not even two hills, right?
No, not at all.
Country Club Hill. Yeah, what happens is these little municipalities, it's hard to generate revenue, right? Because you're competing with each other to get businesses to land there and to get people to move there. And what they end up doing for revenue is just hitting people up for jaywalking, traffic stuff, and they generate their revenue from people. And then if you're poor, like a couple of these things pile on top of one another, it creates this kind of financial spiral. You may not be able to pay, you might end up in jail. And it just, that policy sort of lands heavier on the poorer parts of the region, which correlationally happen to be, you know, people of color. So it was this great piece about how there are these sort of, there's a thread running through the whole century of these practices that people use to sort of try and isolate themselves residentially, and the impact it ends up having, disparate impact on different kinds of communities. And Bloomberg Businessweek, I was surprised to see it there, but they did a similar story. And so the narrative that I wanted to see, which was how do things get to be the way they are, did eventually emerge. So I was like, oh, good. I'm glad the national media is there. Not that nobody in St. Louis had done it, but, you know, a lot of, even if they had, a lot of people from the outside weren't getting the message.
You mentioned the Radley Balco piece. That was a 13,000-word piece in the Washington Post.
And it was a whopper, yeah.
Yeah, and that got a lot of attention. Shane, what are your thoughts on this? It has been really interesting just to see the evolution of the coverage and what reporters focus on. I mean, we're going to definitely talk with you in a bit about the militarization of the police force. But what strikes you about just how this story has evolved over time?
I mean, I think part of what's really interesting about this story in terms of, you know, this militarization of police and these kind of broader issues that I've been focusing on is that it's kind of galvanized, it's brought some old issues to the light in kind of national media, like police militarization, like segregation. You know, these aren't new. I mean, all this stuff is decades or centuries old. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of created this national debate, you know, especially within the media about these major problems that we just haven't been paying attention to, you know, as the largest society.
And Lawrence, in the piece you wrote in the Columbia Journalism Review, Ferguson Before Ferguson, about the year-long series you developed about race and class in Baltimore, you talk about how your series led you to personally explore the intersection between poverty and race. So what lessons do you draw from your own reporting about how journalists should or are covering Ferguson and other communities across the country that are dealing with similar issues?
Well, one, and I think Mariah does this well, I was looking at a lot of her reporting today, you got to try to cover things from the inside of the community out, rather than looking from the outside of the community in. Her pieces are just filled with voices of people who are protesting and talking about why they're protesting, rather than looking at them as numbers, like how many people got arrested today. So that's one thing. And I learned that you have to really make yourself vulnerable, because you have to understand how your own race, how your own class impacts how you're looking at these stories. And this is a bigger issue that it'll take a long time to get for people to do, but you have to disentangle race and class, okay? Because in the beginning of the story, I talk about how I was talking to the head of a black foundation, and I wanted to do this series on the radio about race and class, and I was going to call it Talking About Class, which I didn't mention this in the story, but...
And Lawrence, I hate to cut you off at that point, but we're going to talk about that right after the break, how you decided to go about disentangling race and class and the conversation you had. It's really interesting. Today, it's our media roundtable, and we are talking about media coverage of Ferguson and how the media are shaping the narrative. We'll be back after this.
Lots of ways to take part in today's conversation on Your Call. On the phone or by sending an email, the address for your email is feedback@yourcallradio.org. The toll-free number, 866-798-8255. Coming up at 11 o'clock, World Have Your Say from the BBC. Following that at noon today, the Tavis Smiley Show. And then at 1, Maria Hinojosa and Latino USA.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation about organic farming with Professor Julie Guthman, author of Agrarian Dreams, The Paradox of Organic Farming in California. She says organic farmers are under the same pressures and make many of the same choices as conventional farmers. So what does organic mean now, and is buying organic still a powerful way to change our agricultural system? That is on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about media coverage of what's happening in Ferguson, Missouri. We are awaiting the grand jury to make an announcement over whether to charge police officer Darren Wilson for fatally shooting teenager Michael Brown. And if you'd like to join us, this is getting a lot of attention. Again, this morning, Attorney General Eric Holder appealed for people to, quote, express themselves peacefully. Now, when you look at the headlines, most of them focus on violence, potential violence, I should say, on arrests, schools trying to keep themselves safe. But if you dig a little deeper, as we're talking about today, there are a lot of really good stories out there about inequality, about, you know, segregation, about housing, about redlining. And if you've seen that kind of reporting, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. As we wait for the decision, what kinds of stories would you like reporters to focus on? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Mariah Stewart, the Huffington Post's Ferguson Fellow, now a full-time journalist. Mariah began covering the shooting just days after it occurred without any financial backing. She just finished journalism school. We're also joined by Shane Bauer, senior reporter with Mother Jones. Be sure to check out his piece about the militarization of the police force, The Making of the Warrior Cop. It's at yourcallradio.org. And Lawrence Lenahan, freelance reporter and print journalist, former senior producer of WYPR's Maryland Morning. He and his colleagues won an award for their year-long series about race and class for WYPR Baltimore NPR station. So, Lawrence, before the break, you were talking about a meeting you had. Is this the meeting with Diane Bell McCoy, the yes. president and CEO of the Associated Black Charities?
Yep. The station president had gotten me together with her to talk about funding this series. It was very early on in the process. And there was already Open Society Institute Baltimore had a public event series called Talking About Race. And I thought, why don't we complement that, do this series called Talking About Class, because you talk about class for 2 seconds in Baltimore and it's going to be about race real quick. And I wanted to talk about both. I wanted kind of that intersectionality. And she interrupted me, not you know, in a very calm way, but she just said, that's chicken bleep. Mm. She didn't say bleep. And I, of course, blanched a little bit, but was secretly thrilled because that's the kind of conversations I wanted this region to have, because they have them on either side of the lines between us, you know, in our racial and class silos. But here it was out in the open. She said, if you start talking about class in a room full of black people, all they're going to hear is, I don't want to talk about race. Hmm. And one of my favorite reporters, Nicole Hannah-Jones at ProPublica, in her reporting tries to show that if you're looking at race and class disparities, if you kind of control for class, there's still racial stuff going on. People use class as a proxy for race. Like, let's talk about the economics of it. There's poor whites, there's middle class blacks, but the regional dynamics are often about race. It is often about, you know, whiter communities trying to protect their property values by keeping the community the way it is. And you don't see redlining anymore, but you do see zoning decisions that keep things that way. Like, oh, we don't want any multi-family apartment complexes, you know, which is a proxy for lower income residents. So it's still happening.
And she ended up funding the project.
She did.
Yeah.
She wanted to be at the, she knew it was going to happen. She wanted to be at the table.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let's go to a few callers. Let's hear from Wanda in Berkeley. Hi, Wanda. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. I feel that this is the left keep deflecting the attention and saying that this is a case of race and class, that's the problem here. And that kind of puts the onus of what's happening on the everyday people, you know. But really what's happening is this is state-sponsored terrorism, and this is government-sponsored. These people, that all of these latest spate of young black men who've been killed, the same scenario happened. It was some white thug cop who just killed them in cold blood. And then all of a sudden he's, you know, there's the right-wing media is saying that, well, they're putting, saying he really, you know, had a reason to do it all of a sudden. But in any case, the guy is always going to get off, and we're pretty sure he's going to get off. And then, you know, chaos is created in the city of Ferguson, and more, you know, tighter screws on the people, martial law type of activity of National Guard coming in, which they're already there. And this is not about race and class, as it is about state-sponsored terrorism.
Well,
let me get a comment.
Thank you for calling in, Wanda. Let me get a comment from Mariah. You're in Ferguson. Mariah, you probably have read many more details about the specific case. What are your thoughts on how that has been reported?
The case itself, the fact that we're getting leaks and things, that was, it just adds to the speculation of it. I mean, for the most part, I do feel that news organizations, they are trying their best. They're doing their best job with getting the facts out there. It's so many ways to go on that question. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I mean, for ProPublica last month has a piece called Deadly Force in Black and White, a ProPublica analysis of killings by police shows outsize risk for young black males. Young black males in recent years were at a far greater risk of being shot dead by police than their white counterparts, 21 times greater, according to a ProPublica analysis of federally collected data on fatal police shootings. Lawrence, it seems like these stories are getting so much more play in the past year. I mean, for sad reasons, obviously, but these numbers are really getting out there.
They are, and I've got to attribute a little bit of that to social media. That you do see pressure from social media to cover things that go uncovered, to hold police and policymakers accountable. So I'm not surprised to see more reporting along these lines. And ProPublica has they're young, but they do have a tradition of looking at things through the lens of, are these particular practices or policies having a disparate impact, you know, by race or class. And, a lot of this, I make this point in my story, a lot of this gets boiled down to bigotry. Like, are these cops racist? And while that's important, what's also important is whether they have a perverse incentive to do this. Are policing policies different in black neighborhoods than they are in white? I mean, you don't see SWAT teams raiding dorms to catch pot smokers. But I was just looking at the SWAT raid statistics. Shane, you'll find this interesting. I was looking at the SWAT raid statistics for Maryland for 2014. 60% of the raids were for Part 2 crimes, not violent crimes, for drug crimes. They're trying to find drugs, and they just say, oh, judge, we know this person has a record, or that there's drugs, so they're probably going to want to protect them with guns. So you see different policing in different parts of town.
Shane, you point this out in your piece. You report that 85% of SWAT operations are, quote, choice-driven raids on people's private residences, according to Peter Kraska, an Eastern Kentucky researcher who studies this. 62% of SWAT deployments were for drug raids, 71% when race was known, target people of color. In 1984, 40% of SWAT teams were serving warrants. By 2012, the number was 79. And then the number of SWAT raids across the country have increased 20-fold since the 1980s, going from 3,000 per year to at least 60,000 today? 60,000 SWAT raids a year?
Yeah, and you know, it's worth reiterating that these mostly target people of color. And, you know, when I think this is especially relevant when we think of why SWAT teams were created in the late 60s and early 70s. It was for, you know, the kind of active shooter situations where you have somebody just, like, shooting up crowds or holding hostages, these kind of extreme situations. And those situations, statistically, are mostly done by white people. But what's happening now is SWAT teams are mostly used to raid houses for drugs. You know, this is not a kind of response to violence kind of situation, and in those raids, you know, they're mostly targeting people of color, you know, houses where people of color live. I recently wrote a piece about a case in Texas, two cases where there was two different situations where police SWAT teams had done no-knock raids before dawn on people's houses, on two different people's houses, for looking for drugs. And in both cases, the people in the house shot a police officer and killed a police officer. This is actually not uncommon with no-knock raids. And, you know, if you imagine somebody busting into your house at 5 in the morning, you don't know who it is. If you are armed, which a lot of people in Texas are, you know, and you're waking up in the middle of the night, you might fire on them. So both these situations, the person killed a police officer. In one situation, the suspect was white. In one situation, the suspect was black. And the black man is currently facing execution, while the white man is not. And the black man actually didn't have drugs in his house.
Well, that is Shane Bauer, senior reporter at Mother Jones. Recently wrote the piece, The Making of the Warrior Cop. We're also joined by Lawrence Lanahan, freelance radio and print journalist. When he was at WYPR in Baltimore, he and his team won a DuPont Award for their year-long investigation, The Lines Between Us, a series about race and class in Maryland. And we're joined by Mariah Stewart, Huffington Post's Ferguson Fellow, who is now a full-time journalist covering what is happening on the ground in Ferguson. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's go next to Joseph in Berkeley. Hi, Joseph.
Yes, good morning. I just have a brief comment about race before my question. First of all, I think someone may have said earlier in the show that when white people talk about class, black people perceive it as that they don't want to talk about race. Well, I just want to say it's not really a perception by black people that white people don't want to talk about race. In general, white people who want to talk about class or say it's really about state terrorism or whatever, don't want to talk about race. Because if they did talk about race, then they'd have to analyze the system in which even liberal, progressive, and leftist whites unfairly benefit from that system, whether they like it or not. So when white people, I'm making a generalization, do want to talk about race, they want to talk about it purely as a matter of someone's personal sentiment and not as a system of institutional power. So my comment for the question is, I'm wondering if there's a difference between the national print media or aspects thereof that your guests have been discussing today as doing good reporting, and the national broadcast media, because Tefpo, who's a rapper activist from Ferguson, was on Hard Knock Radio on KTFA yesterday, interviewed by Davey D, and a David Banner, who's also a rapper activist, was on Hard Knock Radio, interviewed by Davey D on Monday of this week, the 17th, and people can go to kkfa.org, Hard Knock Radio, and hear the audio archives, and they have said, especially with regard to the national media, that if you just listen to the national media about Ferguson, you are not getting the truth. And to my surprise, I heard a USA Today reporter who's a black female, I think her name is Yamish, I'm not sure, but she was reporting on the PBS NewsHour and other venues, and she was even giving misleading reporting on Ferguson. And so I assume that, you know, whatever color you are, if you want to keep your job or get along with your colleagues or be promotable at the national media.
Well, Joseph, thank you for calling. We've got full lines. And so if you can all, and I want to get you all in, but if you have specific media questions, because we have three journalists on talking about this, that would be great. And so have any of you noticed major differences between print media and broadcast media? Mariah, are you paying attention to that?
Yes. And that's where my sour note from national media came in, is because of broadcast media. I actually went to school to do broadcasting. I thought that was my dream. And through the events of Ferguson, that has completely changed my mind about broadcasting.
Are you talking about television specifically?
Television specifically.
Okay, I had the same experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. So why did that happen to you?
Yeah, they touch down and they come to get their shot, and it's very impersonal for them when they're here.
And so what are you seeing in, what about local news in your area? What does that look like, local TV news?
They're okay, but it's you cannot sum up what is going on in a three-minute news package. It's
right.
just impossible. And it's kind of on to the next fluff news story. There's just this lack of love that comes with television news.
Lawrence, did you want to jump in?
I haven't had cable. I haven't had cable in 15 years.
Okay,
I'll pass on this one.
All right, all right. Well. Thank you for the call. Let's go to our next caller, Chris in Oakland. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks a lot. I wanted to mention that I had seen a really well done 30-minute documentary on Fusion TV. We just rehooked up our cable, by the way, and. It's not that great, except Fusion is new to me, and it was a great piece called Hands Up, Don't Shoot, a 30-minute documentary.
Hmm.
And then I wanted to ask the journalists if you think that especially the predominant national media coverage of Ferguson, do you think that invites people or scares people away from participating in any kind of protest?
Oh, that's an interesting one. What are your thoughts on this, Mariah? Because when the National Guard arrived in Ferguson on Monday, what were you hearing from protesters about whether or not they're going to take to the streets? Given that, and then what we saw last time around with the riot gear and then the arrests.
Well, the protesters, they're definitely planning on organized and structured protests, nothing that's going to be violent. I think what's going to happen is, you know, if in the event of chaos and things in the streets, is you're going to get people who weren't out here with the regular protesters, and it's going to be your outsiders. We got a little bit of that these past 2 days as national media has descended into Ferguson. You get these new people, and they're charging up the crowd.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, Shane, how does the cop in the riot gear affect the psyche of someone who wants to go out and demonstrate?
I mean, you can just imagine, you know, going to a protest, if you've ever been to a protest where there's not police around or minimal police presence versus being at a protest where there's vehicles that look like tanks, police that look like soldiers wearing camo or all black helmets, have sniper rifles. I mean, it's just night and day difference. And there are studies in the works. There's one from UC Berkeley that, you know, the preliminary findings at least are that protests tend to be more violent when police are, you know, have this kind of heavy kind of militaristic presence. It creates an immediate tension between the protesters and the police.
And is this the path that we're taking? I mean, what do you foresee based on the reporting that you've done? Because in your latest piece, I mean, you spent time at the convention center of the Oakland Marriott. Was that earlier this year, a couple months ago?
A couple months ago.
Okay. And so basically it was filled with SWAT teams selling all kinds of toys and, I mean, I shouldn't say toys, drones, sniper rifles, armored vehicles. Even, I was shocked, bayonets? I mean, they're selling bayonets?
Right.
What? Who's using bayonets?
They weren't selling those there, actually. And this is, you know, there's kind of two big pots of money where this stuff is coming from. One is from the Department of Defense, which, you know, we've heard a lot about in the news, where there's kind of old military equipment going to police. That's where the bayonets and the grenade launchers are coming from. But there's a much, much larger pot of money, $41 billion since 2002, that Homeland Security is giving to local police. And these are grants. This is money, not equipment. So then, you know, these police are turning to this massive, what is now a massive industry, and buying this kind of equipment. And, you know, interestingly, there is a connection between, you know, what we're seeing with the police in Ferguson and what's happening in the Middle East, because the justification, the way that police get this equipment is from, or this money from Homeland Security is by explaining how it will be used for counterterrorism, you know, and this is typically referencing Islamic terrorism. Of course, that's not generally how it's used. It's used mostly for drug raids and, in some cases, protests. And once, you know, once they have this equipment, they can use it however they want. But, you know, what I saw at this convention is that there are companies that are popping up now, new companies with new equipment. They're trying to create these niches because there's so much money out there. One example, which actually the vendor was calling a toy, was this device that you attach to a gun, and it sends out radio waves that temporarily blinds the person that it's pointed at for 10 minutes, and it makes them nauseous. And, you know, I heard him talking to a member of a SWAT team, and he was saying, you know, imagine you go into a bar fight, you just blind everybody, and then figure out what's going on. You know, and they talk about this stuff. He actually talks about this in terms of Ferguson. You know, the way that they kind of justify using this equipment is, well, it would be better to use this than to shoot somebody. You know, so there's this kind of rhetoric around it that it's like, you know, it's less than lethal equipment.
The guy insisted this device caused no permanent damage, hence the name Zero, as in zero damage. This is going to be on the market in January.
Who is going to
be able to buy these devices? I mean, is someone on the street going to be able to own a gun that renders someone blind for 10 minutes?
You know, I don't know. I would assume that it would be only available for law enforcement, but probably any police department can buy it. And, you know, I've tried to get at the science of how this thing works, and they have not returned those calls. But, you know, they say that the guy told me that it scrambles your ocular fluid.
Wow. You report that, so this event is Urban Shield, the largest first responder training in the world, mostly paid for by the Department of Homeland Security. More than 100 corporations paid about $25,000 each, including the corporate sponsors Verizon, Motorola, and then many were military supply companies. Platinum sponsors like Uber gave police discount black car rides for the weekend. How are journalists treated there? You had some interesting experiences once people found out who you were.
Yeah, it was interesting because I've been to the convention, these kind of conventions before. I've been to prison conventions, and there's always, you know, kind of a tension. And when I arrived, I was actually really surprised at how open it was. People were talking to me pretty openly, vendors. As by the third day, the feeling had changed a lot. And I was going to, part of this convention is that there is a 48-hour competition between SWAT teams that was involving local SWAT teams, it was involving the U.S. Marines, it was involving UC Berkeley SWAT team, some international SWAT teams, and I was going to see some of these, which as media I was allowed to do, but I had my press credentials revoked pretty suddenly on the third or the fourth day, actually, and they you know told me that I was filming in an unauthorized location, and which I literally didn't know kind of what they were referring to, and nobody ever told me where that was supposedly. We were just kicked out and not allowed to come back.
Shane Bauer, senior reporter with Mother Jones. Check out his piece, The Making of the Warrior Cop, at yourcallradio.org. We've got time for just a couple more callers. We're also joined by Lawrence Lanahan, radio journalist, and Mariah Stewart, Huffington Post Ferguson Fellow. She's in Ferguson. Let's hear from Mark in San Francisco. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for another excellent program. It seems to me that there are these very large issues of the militarization of the police and racism in society and all of these things that are being talked about. My question for the panel, and maybe particularly the reporter in Ferguson, is what about this particular situation with this particular police officer and this shooting? I fear that it's being used to stand in for everything else that's wrong. And there's a grand jury process going on, which presumably is hearing evidence and going through a careful process, we would hope, of deciding whether there is sufficient evidence to indict this officer. And I'm curious about whether there's any feeling of respect for that process, and particularly in Ferguson, does anyone care what they're talking about? Does anyone think that it's a legitimate process, and shouldn't we care?
All right. Mariah, do you want to take that? Thank you, Mark.
Well, the problem is if you come to Ferguson or the St. Louis region, everyone has pretty much their own story, a personal experience they had with law enforcement, with the courts, where it was just an unfair situation. So the problem is there's this already distrust between law officials, public figures, and regular, ordinary citizens. So the respect for the grand jury process, it may be there, but it's the faith, I think, has gone with a lot of these people in the community, just because they, if they haven't had a personal experience, they know someone who's had a run-in that just, it didn't seem fair to them. So distrust, I think, is the main thing here. I've been going to courts here in the 90 municipalities, and if you just sit in, you'll see what these people go through. It's unjustly, for the most part. And so the grand jury process, the faith, I think, has been gone.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling. And to check out reporting by Mariah, you've got a really great piece I'm just looking at right now. These Ferguson protesters have become some of the movement's most prominent voices. You've got photos of protesters along with their stories, and that's at yourcallradio.org. Mariah Stewart is Huffington Post's Ferguson Fellow. She began covering the shooting just days after it occurred, and now we are happy to hear that she's a full-time journalist. Lawrence Lanahan is a freelance radio and print journalist, former senior producer of WYPR's Maryland Morning, and Shane Bauer is a senior reporter at Mother Jones covering criminal justice and human rights. Thank you all for joining us.
Thanks, Rose.
Thank you, and thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. As organic farming has grown and gone mainstream, how has it changed? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Professor Julie Guffman, author of Agrarian Dreams, The Paradox of Organic Farming in California. She says organic farmers are under the same pressures and make many of the same choices as conventional farmers. So what does organic mean now? And is buying organic still a powerful way to change our agricultural system? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Matt Martin and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Becca Hoekstra produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be right back.